Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today are Dr. Maren Lead, the Executive Director of the National Spectrum Consortium, and Brian Clark, a retired United States Navy commander and submariner who leads the Center for Defense Concepts and Technology at the Hudson Institute think tank. They teamed up on a great event, the Invisible Battlefield, regaining electromagnetic spectrum superiority. It follows a report a couple of weeks ago, strangely enough, called The Invisible Battlefield, the Technology Strategy for Electromagnetic Spectrum Superiority. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
Maren, absolute pleasure welcoming you on the program. It's been too long. Brian, thank you for joining us and making time for us. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Why don't we start with you, Maren, right? I mean, you're now the executive director of a national organization that looks at spectrum. Obviously, the electromagnetic battlefield is something that Brian, but a lot of military strategists and yourself have been thinking about for some time. What are the challenges and the opportunities the United States military faces in the electromagnetic spectrum?
Well, I think Brian's report does a great job laying out the strategic environment and the competition that is surrounding the EMS at present and going forward, right? We have two very determined great powers who are making rapid strides in both their own EMS capabilities and in countering ours. And so what I thought was so useful about the Hudson report is that it takes this net assessment approach to identifying the asymmetries across the three main players in the electromagnetic competition, the US, China, and Russia, going through a strategy for how the US might adapt to areas where an equivalent approach may not be in our best interest or be most effective, and then how we can exploit some of the areas where we have a more natural advantage. So they had a very useful quote that I thought was really accurate. Information superiority is primarily treated as a means to enable efficient fires by the US rather than as a way to directly achieve battlefield advantage, which is more how the Chinese and the Russians are thinking about it.
Brian, give us a sense, right? I mean, you joined us a couple of weeks ago and talked about the fact the report was coming out. It's now out, and you guys have now had your event. Same question to you, right? Where do you see challenge? Where do you see opportunity? And what are some of the key takeaways from the report?
Kind of some of the big challenges, like Maren was saying, are because our adversaries have done a good job studying us and have developed a set of systems that are designed to exploit what they perceive as our major vulnerabilities, which are the ones we ourselves perceive. So we are a highly networked force. We are hierarchical to a pretty large degree. So if you can interfere with our communications, we start to fall apart a little bit. We have not equipped our junior commanders, our field commanders, to be able to make decisions on their own with the kinds of new systems we're giving them. So we're giving them a bunch of new capabilities. At the same time, we're not giving them the ability to make smart plans and decisions with those capabilities. And so our adversaries have learned that, figured it out, and built a system of systems on both sides, both China and Russia, that are designed to kind of take apart our approach to warfare that lots of really smart people have written about, you know, Bob Work and others, this asymmetry that exists between us. The opportunity to kind of get out of this cycle, this bad cycle of you know, them developing a set of systems and then us sort of slowly trying to respond, is to try to come up with a new way of fighting that gives us an inherent advantage against what they are doing, which is a little bit more static. You know, to Maren's point, you know, they're focusing on information advantage. They've built a system of systems to give them information advantage, but it's all predicated on what they perceive as our approach, what our operational concepts and capabilities. So if we could be less predictable, more adaptable, give our field commanders, our lower echelons, greater capability and adaptability and decision support, we might be able to create a force that's able to actually operate in the backyard of a place like China or Russia and present them with challenges and dilemmas along the lines of kind of classical maneuver warfare. And you hear military leaders talk about this. You hear General Berger from the Marine Corps talk about this. You hear General Hyten talk about this, this need to move away from a predictable sort of attrition-focused approach to warfare and become more maneuver-centric, which we talk about being decision-centric. And the technologies are there. The event today was really great because it highlighted the fact that we do have a lot of technology development in DoD that could be harnessed to support this. And it's really getting those technologies across the finish line that's needed. Congress is concerned. Congressman Langevin and Congressman Bacon were on the panel, and they both talked about the need to deliver these new technologies to the warfighters, that we've got what's going on in the labs is actually making its way out to the field. That I think is where the opportunities are, which was encouraging from the conversation today, that we have a path forward. And then the question is just, can OSD, the services, and Congress work together to make that transition? And I think the National Spectrum Consortium and the work that Marin's people are doing there is a key element of it, because there's a lot of what they're doing that directly supports these kinds of technologies.
Marin, so the question, though, and the challenge is, right, the United States government has been selling off spectrum for some time. Obviously, it's very important for commercial growth, 5G being something that is seen as game-changing. Yeah, and I want to get to how it's game-changing in the military space, right? I mean, we have a tendency of thinking about 5G and, we can send our cat videos to each other a little more quickly, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Absolutely.
Marin, how do we handle the challenge of divestiture of spectrum? It's going into the commercial space, but then that's constricting available bandwidth for the military at the very time that our adversaries are actually expanding their use of the entire space, right? I mean, we're not the only guys targeting 5G for military application. What's the right way ahead to balance commercial interests with national security?
Well, so one of the things that we talked about in the panel today is, Brian's report talks a lot about the need for greater agility, right? And so the domestic spectrum sell-off of DoD government spectrum more generally, and DoD in particular, it could be seen, and I think has not been fully leveraged, the smaller amount of spectrum and the greater imperative for sharing that the Defense Department has to do represents an opportunity for them to force greater agility into their systems, right? That the challenge will be, as Brian alluded to earlier, ensuring that we leverage the capabilities that are being developed to enable that sharing, and that we leverage those not just in the context of domestic spectrum management, but also in our operational forces and our operational capabilities for warfighting. And so there's a cultural challenge here. The Defense Department's electromagnetic spectrum superiority strategy talks about how we've had a spectrum management strategy prior, and we've had an electronic warfare strategy, and this electromagnetic spectrum operations is intended to bring those into a more coherent collective whole. And that's the right language. We don't yet have the organizational ligatures and the behavioral and the cultural and the even semantic tissue to try to make that real in the way that I think, again, while the sell-off of spectrum is absolutely, it poses challenges for the Defense Department, there's no question. It also creates this opportunity to develop the solutions that allow for agility, that, and it's not going to fully translate into war fighting. I mean, there are absolutely operational use cases in the contested environment that extend beyond what's required in a more collaborative context. But some of that same technology, some of the same types of algorithms, some of the same types of data fabric that are required to support the cooperative functioning are also highly relevant in the contested operational environment. So I think we have a real chance here to bring those things into a greater into a more coherent whole and build off some of the advances that past auctions have forced us to develop. They can really help jumpstart us more into the world that Brian rightly says that we need going forward.
So, Brian, is the electromagnetic strategy, the department's electromagnetic strategy, on the right track?
Yeah, I was really encouraged and surprised. I mean, I wasn't really surprised, I guess, but I was pleasantly surprised.
I was surprised they got it right. Impressive. Good Lord.
No, because I helped, I collaborated and contributed to it. So, but it was very encouraging that stuff made it through. I guess what was surprising to me was that at the end of the day, after going through the massive staffing process those things go through, that it still had these kind of edges to it that really set some priorities for things that are not going to be easy or popular in a lot of ways. So the idea of sharing more spectrum with civilian users is not something that's inherently going to be attractive to the military, because that's change and nobody likes change. But those capabilities are going to redound back to the government. The military is going to benefit from having these kind of dynamic spectrum sharing and agile capabilities. Also, if we think about more broadly this competition between the United States and China that everybody's talking about in the new administration. It's not just about military competition. So there's multiple dimensions to this, and 5G is another part of the playing field. And so to be able to have viable Open RAN 5G competitors to Huawei, we can't rely on those export controls that are currently keeping Huawei on the ropes. They're eventually going to sort through that and come up with a new supply chain. Right. So we got to have, what's our approach to actually gain an enduring advantage in that 5G competition? Well, we got to field competitors. We got to get some U.S. competitors that are involved in Open RAN and 5G, which means we got to give them the spectrum to be able to compete and to offer 5G in the mid-band particularly, that unfortunately DoD likes to own a lot of, because that's a great band for radars and radios, as well as 5G radio interfaces. So it's essential to the overall competition that we start to share, but things like that are not going to be popular in DoD. So I was encouraged that all made it through, and this focus on maneuverability in the spectrum made it through, which is different than the approach that DoD has had, which is sort of a move counter move. You think about the history of electronic warfare back in World War II and the Cold War. It was the other guy builds something, then we build a countermeasure, then he builds a new thing that addresses our countermeasure, and then we build another countermeasure. So it was this move, countermove in jammers and radars and radios. And that was sort of easy for people to understand. The alternative that we're advocating today and in our report and then in strategy is that instead of trying to move, countermove on over weeks and months, we create systems that are able to adapt in real time. So somebody generates a new jamming technique, our radar is able to quickly figure it out and come up with a technique to avoid it, because it's going to be maneuvering outside that area of spectrum, or it's going to counter it through some kind of pulse characteristics. This idea of cognitive radar, cognitive electronic warfare, and that competition is going to play out now. And then Dave Tremper from OSD talked about the need to go increasingly to passive sensing. Part of how we avoid and are agile in the spectrum is by not emitting, by actually being passive in our use of the spectrum. So that's part of the agility equation as well. And so I was encouraged that the report, the strategy rather, echoed a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of passive sensing and LPI, LPD communications as being the future, because that's also a way to be agile and avoid your adversaries. But that's all. Those are all big changes.
You skated to where my question was going to go, right? Because I was going to ask you whether or not that the whole Cold War mindset that we had of measure countermeasure was going to be effective. Marin, we've seen, whether it's the prolonged debate about Legato or any other opening of mid-band spectrum, as Brian mentioned, right? I mean, there is this sense of sort of hampering commercial industry at a time we should be, letting it roam free and develop new technologies that the department can then capitalize on. What's the support DoD needs from industry and the Hill to do this, to do it right, so that we regain both commercial, globally competitive advantage, and I want to get to that in just a moment, but also, balance the national security equity of that. And in fact, the virtuous cycle would be the national investment in a capability that gives commercial benefit as well as security advantage.
Well, I think we're actually seeing some of that in action right now, right? DoD's 5G initiative, that they have identified 12 bases where they're going to be building out 5G networks in ways that have not proven feasible in a truly commercial context, right? Are exactly the kind of experimental test beds that will both allow the Defense Department to have an advanced laboratory to understand the challenges and opportunities that 5G technologies as they mature will present to them, at the same time that they are pushing commercial and giving commercial companies the opportunity to advance their own technology in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise. And so I think it's actually an ideal example of that is very powerful. I was just, there was a discussion yesterday between the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the members of the NSC who are going to be submitting proposals for work at Joint Base San Antonio, one of which is really one aspect of which will focus on security of the 5G core networks, and another of which will focus on telemedicine applications and remote 5G enabled telehealth training. And so again, perfect dual use use cases in that context. And then they've got multiple other ones at other bases. They have, smart warehouse applications. They have a whole set of dual use cases that are going to help propel the technology forward in a way that neither side would be able to attack nearly as efficiently or as in a technically informed way as this particular effort is going ahead with. And really, the Defense Department activity in this area is the flagship for the federal government as a whole, right? And will inform other departments and hopefully the structure of any potential infrastructure investments, et cetera, right? So right. I think that's a terrific example of exactly the kind of specific, directed, focused, experimental venues and that are going to push us where we need to be going.
Brian, I want to go to the commercial advantage question, right? I mean, the last administration put an enormous amount of pressure on Huawei, as we've discussed, to wean themselves off of the technology that could be a security problem. The problem is the United States doesn't really have the technology. Whatever we have tends to be expensive. And the only other competitors or significant competitors in the market are Ericsson of Sweden and Nokia of Finland at the end of the day. I know that you've written about this. So how do we do this? Are there elements of the Chinese technology that are actually perfectly safe and usable? We're having this same discussion now on power equipment, right? The administration is looking at it and saying, look, not everything is totally unusable and penetrated, right? Or potentially compromised. And then what does a competitive roadmap look like? Because it's not abundantly clear the United States either has the technology or is on the right side of the cost curve to make it as globally attractive as Huawei was, right? Which is why Huawei makes the commercial case. This is less about security than it is us having made the investment and trying to benefit from it, and you guys didn't do it, and it's not our fault that you didn't.
Yeah. So what we what we advocated was a two-pronged strategy. So you're absolutely right. Huawei has got really good radio access network hardware. So the actual radio interface between your cell phone and the cell network. And they've put a lot of money into that. It's been subsidized by the government, but they've got some good hardware that's efficient, has low cost over time. It has low power demands, which helps to contribute to the low cost. It reduces the size of the generators you need. All those things create a cascade of lower costs for the Huawei system. There are parts of that you could use. The antenna hardware, for example, some of the power cabling. There's things that Huawei has in their systems that clearly is not really open for exploitation because it's just hardware. The U.S. alternative that is being proposed, or the international alternative, is Open RAN, which is a system where you have open standards within your 5G radio access network, and then you can mix and match piece parts to create your own system, which is kind of how 4G LTE works today. But that open architecture set of standards is being still finalized. And in the US, you don't have players providing every piece of that Open RAN hardware, the radio access network, the amplifiers for the baseband, carrier wave, some of the electronic components that connect them. Those aren't all necessarily being made in the US. But they'll soon be. The biggest impediment to having a U.S. competitor for Open RAN is just an integrator. So companies that actually pull this together in the same way that Huawei pulls together a setup and gives a turnkey system to the mobile network operator. So they go to Verizon or they go to their, the overseas counterpart of Verizon and say, we'll build this system for you and turn it over to you. And all you got to do is turn it on. we need that same kind of integrator in the U.S. to get a real Open RAN competitor. And that's something that's being aggressively pursued today by the government, by some commercial entities on the carrier side. So Verizon, AT&T, all pursuing developing that integrator to be able to give you 5G in the US without having to bring in Huawei. So there's a path to that. The other prong of the strategy, though, is that 5G radio access network competition is kind of the low end of the competition. Eventually, that will become commoditized and just the lowest price competitor will win. The bigger part of the competition, the more lucrative one, is on the core network side. So where does that 5G radio access network hook up? It's the core network. And that core network is where the companies that do cloud computing and 5G of the future, that's where they're going to make their money, because that's where all the services are going to be. That's where the software-enabled data analysis and machine learning could all be applied. So that's really where the U.S. needs to focus its attention, on that upper part of the value chain. But that two-part strategy, I think, we think would be effective, and that's something that is being pursued by folks in the U.S. Commercial and government side.
Mara?
Well, I think the other key aspect of this really has to do with the strategic competition and the international standards that are set and adopted worldwide, right? And again, the National Spectrum Consortium has just started, created these working groups to try to create a forum for providing a more collaborative environment for companies, U.S. companies, to go into those standards bodies and potentially coordinate with other international standards bodies in ways that can advance alternative solutions to get adopted as standards. The Chinese have been extremely effective in attacking those standards bodies and getting Chinese developed standards adopted. And we have been very slow to respond to that. And part of the challenge there is because of the nature of our system, right? The government doesn't drive that input. That's commercially driven, and our competitive environment sometimes has inhibited us from taking a longer or more or broader view of that competition. But I think there's a growing appreciation of the need to challenge that, or we'll be building in vulnerabilities from the get-go. So that is an essential part of getting ourselves in a better competitive position in the longer term. And that is, as soon as the upcoming 3GPP release at the end of the year. So there's, we're a little bit behind the power curve there, but again, trying hard to move out. The government's encouraging industry to do that. And I think that's a big part of making sure that we don't, you know, miss the forest for the trees and try to influence those international standards that get put into place around the globe.
Brian, any last thoughts on it? Because I think that, you know, Maren is absolutely right, right? From an international standard setting position, the Chinese have been brilliant in infiltrating all of these sort of impenetrable, you know, IEEE and a whole bunch of other organizations, and whether they're in Switzerland or anywhere else, in order to be able to start setting the standards to their advantage. And it's been subtle and remarkably successful, even if it has become increasingly overt over the past couple of years. How do we need to be thinking about the problem in order to make sure that we hit it with the right solution? Because frankly, there are
I think there's that great synergistic effect they're able to get because they're developing the technology while simultaneously being involved in developing the standards for that technology. So in 5G, that worked out well for them with Huawei and ZTE to a lesser degree. So we have to think about not just getting involved in the standards bodies, but also aggressively pursuing the technology development that allows us to inform the standards to try to drive them in a direction that is more advantageous for us based on how we're pursuing the technology. And because we're a little bit behind on developing the 5G technology, and that goes back to some historical challenges in our own telecommunications industry, because we were slow on the technology, we didn't really have a good way to drive the standards in a way that was beneficial to us. We're going to have to reverse that as we move into whatever the next generation of telecommunications networking is.
And we are already behind there as well, right? So thinking past 5G, we've got to pick up the pace to ensure we don't lose the march again.
How many years behind are we? So how many years does it take for us to catch up? Because our catching up also will determine, right, will depend on how quickly Verizon and AT&T and all of these leading edge companies catch up, right? Because these guys have been buying this gear.
Well, I think that's it's different world, parts right? of the overall 5G ecosystem. And I think part of what Brian has advocated for is that a lot of our advantage is going to be in the application layer. Right. And that is not as reliant on the telecoms, right? And this is, I think, again, where this broad set of experimental environments that DoD is setting up, there's also a pretty extensive and highly capable set of lab environments that the National Science Foundation has. As more and more of that is used by companies who have a lot to offer at the application layer, that should really accelerate the and move us into our area of advantage as the telecoms work on aspects of the core and the RAN piece.
Yeah, the radio access network, the radio that connects you to the cell network, that's going to become more and more just the hardware layer that's going to get increasingly commoditized. But then everything beyond the antenna essentially is going to be virtualized. That's the big benefit of 5G, is that right now the 4G LTE network is pretty much hardware until you get to the internet. And now with 5G, the idea is to virtualize it and put it on computer software once you get past the antenna, which means you can offer all kinds of new services through your 5G network. And there's a huge opportunity there because that is an area where the US has an advantage. We do a lot of cloud computing. We have a lot of software companies here. We tend to have the lead on those things. So that's an opportunity to gain an edge, but it's all fundamentally based on getting some 5G here in the United States that could be a test bed for it.
Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure. Maren, thank you. Brian, thank you for being a repeat customer, and look forward to welcoming you guys both back on increasingly over time. Thanks so much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.